Hello there. I am Tim Noah.
And I'm Jim Pinkerton.
And you're Jim Pinkerton. I'm a senior writer for Slate Magazine, and you, Jim, are?
A fellow at the New America Foundation and a contributor to the Fox News Channel.
Right. And a one-time policy aide for Reagan and Bush.
41.
41. Bush won, right. And we used to actually, way back when, we used to talk now and then when I was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal.
I do remember that, yes.
Well, we have too many things to talk about.
Okay.
But I think the first thing we absolutely have to talk about is, which I'm quite alarmed about, I read it over this weekend, is the cover story in the Atlantic Monthly, The End of Men, by Hannah Rosen, who, full disclosure, is the wife of my boss, David Plotz. The subhead is How Women Are Taking Control of Everything. And I have to say, Jim, this is very bad for our team.
It would be bad if it were really happening.
Well, it seems to me, I have to say, I have been doing some research on a project whose full nature I cannot disclose because it's a long-term project. But I have been coming across some of the same research that Hannah drew on, and it does seem to be distressingly true that in the labor market, men do seem to be losing a great deal of ground to women, particularly when it comes to income. And this follows a trend that we all knew about already, which is that our colleges seem to be experiencing some difficulty filling their quota of men all of a sudden, which is quite an unexpected. I think if I had told you 20 years ago that colleges would be devising affirmative action programs to get more men in, you would have told me I was out of my mind. But something like that does seem to be happening. Do you dispute those?
I don't dispute those data. What I dispute, though, is that it means that either men are ending, and I'm sure that Hannah, you know, and her headline writers looking for a provocative, cover story went for something like end of. What it does seem to me, though, is that all through history, women tend to fill in institutions that men create. And when those institutions get full of women, then men create another institution, or they start a war. Stipulating that it's perfectly fine if women are the majority of college students and law students and business executives and everything else, I really don't.
So is our strategy to be to say, okay, ladies, you're going to have three spots on the Supreme Court, but you know what? We think being a Supreme Court justice is really stupid.
I think something like that is exactly. I think that's frankly what happens.
It's hard for me to imagine a world in which being a Supreme Court justice is really stupid.
Well, no, it's not. There's just something better. Apple computer CEO, for example.
I've been having nightmares, of course, about this ever since I read it, about, a future where I thought, well, what happens here if men keep getting dumber and dumber and less able to hold jobs? What you're going to have is you're going to have women occupying the top jobs, or at least the top jobs that they choose to occupy, because there are a lot of jobs that women may not choose to occupy because they may not grant them sufficient flexibility, because men are also too stupid to keep house and raise the children. So women fill up these female desirable jobs. The jobs they deem undesirable will have to be filled by immigrants, and domestic bred men will no longer be considered what William Julius Wilson has referred to as marriageable males. So American women will have no choice but to marry immigrants, and American bred men will have nowhere to go. You're going to have to round them up and put them in concentration camps.
Unless the American bred men decide to round up the women and the immigrant men first. men left to their, and you and I can speak to this, left to their own devices, most men would just as soon sit around and do nothing but drink beer and, you know, watch football. But every now and then they get up and fight a war, which is kind of important in history. And every now and then some man invents some machine, whether it's the gun or the automobile or the airplane or something, that changes everything.
And so you're saying, men, the deal with men is that we're mostly lazy and good for nothing, but we have these moments of inspiration, so we kind of lack cruising speed.
Right. Men, and this is just a fact, men have a wider spread on the notorious bell curve. There are more brilliant men and more stupid men, and women tend to cluster more in the middle. That's not an arguable.
But the middle is important. I mean, I gather already in the development world, it's apparently well known that when you're kind of handing out, you know, sort of microloans and things like that, it's really a bad idea to give them to guys because they blow it on booze or prostitutes. You sort of give it to the women. They actually spend it on their family.
That's true. You're exactly right. But whose idea was the microloan? Muhammad Yunus, a man.
Yes, a man, right.
Well, so in other words, men create, I mean, you know, look, Woodrow Wilson.
So there'll be like 12 guys who are really smart, and then what happens to the rest of us?
Well, I mean, that is an interesting issue, and there's been plenty of cultures where they practice polygamy, for example. Which means that there's if you have a polygamous thing where one man can have, you know, 100 wives or whatever number, then obviously you've got a lot of excess men you got to get rid of. Mm-hmm. And traditionally they've driven them off and shunned them and sent them off to get killed in wars. I mean, these renegade Mormons in Arizona in Utah, you know, Mr. Jeffs, Jeffs, you know, they would just kick out a good chunk of the boys, you know, when they got anywhere near puberty, just because they didn't want to upset their polygamous situation. So, no, this is, I mean, it's not that men are nice at all. You know, in the Ottoman Empire, when, you know, there would be a Turkish sultan would have 100 wives and therefore, you know, 300 children, and when one of them became sultan, he would immediately kill, you know, all his half-brothers.
But in modern history, I mean, men have screwed up a lot in modern history. Men for a long time have been, have committed most of the violence, and most of the crimes and so forth. And, you know, we were, you know, emotionally retarded and we had all sorts of faults. But by golly, the one thing we knew how to do was to make a buck. And the import of Hannah's piece is that we don't even know how to do that anymore.
Oh, well, that explains why, you know, Steve Jobs, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates are all women, I guess, huh?
They're outliers.
That's my point. Outliers are the shapers of the civilization.
Right, but surely we will be seeing female outliers as well.
Maybe. We'll see. We haven't seen them yet.
Well, I'll agree with you thus far. I don't think Carly Fiorina or Meg Whitman are outliers.
Well, I mean, look, there's not. The question is not whether women have talent. The point is, if you were to pick the 15 people who have most shaped the history of the 20th and early 21st century, I suspect it would be all men.
Well,
for better or worse, and
you're
throwing Hitler and Chairman Mao and, you know, Franklin Roosevelt. Anybody, you know, make any list you want. I really don't think you'd, you know, find a way to get a woman on that list.
I don't know. I think if you were putting together the top five political leaders in the United States, Nancy Pelosi would have to be on the list.
Well, most speakers of the House in the 20th century, and for that matter, the 19th century, are pretty forgettable. It's not ultimately a very important job in the historical scheme of things. There are no speakers of the House on coins or, you know, Mount Rushmore or, you know, they're just, you know.
Maybe not, but I'm not sure we'd have health care reform if it weren't for Nancy Pelosi. Might think that would have been a good thing, but.
She's a powerful and smart woman, but when the history of the 21st century is written, I guarantee she'll be a small part of it.
What about Alice Waters? No, seriously. This woman has had we may one day look back on this era and say the only significant figure of this era was Alice Waters.
Well, if that's true, then a thousand years from now, if that's proven to be true, I will personally come back and apologize for my stupid comments just now.
Now, what about this? There's a parenting sidebar to this piece, too. I don't know if you read. I found it somewhat disturbing because I am a male single parent. But it said that that guys make terrible parents, that fathers are entirely unnecessary, which actually runs counter to everything I've read about this previously, including by my college chum David Blankenhorn. That men are actually, fathers are actually quite necessary to upbringing, and certainly the absence of them it has been thought to cause an awful lot of social calamity.
Yeah, this is why I confess, as I read both of those pieces, I began to be suspicious of the whole editorial project here, and the cynic in me began to wonder whether this is just, again, people looking for provocative headlines to sell magazines or get clicks, you know.
But she said that they actually can't find any hard evidence that dads make a difference at all.
Well, I mean, you don't believe that. I don't believe that. You know, this is one of those cases where, you know, who are you going to believe? You know, as Groucho Marx said, me or your own two eyes. if 50 million.
Well, I tell you, one thing I have observed, and this does not constitute an endorsement of the philosophy that dads don't matter. But one thing I have observed is and I observed this a long time ago before I was even aware of this debate. Lesbian parents, in my experience, make fabulous parents. For it has always seemed to me the simple reason that you got two women raising kids. What could be better? Women are highly competent at raising children, and that has been my experience. The sort of gay parents who I know, and they're all women. I don't know what the numbers are. I think probably a lot fewer men are even interested in raising kids. But the female gay parents that I have known have been remarkably good. And I have occasionally wondered, gee, is there something to this notion of one mommy good, two mommies better? Do you have thoughts about this?
You know, maybe. I mean, it's probably not going to be a large-scale phenomenon, no matter how you slice it. And and if, you know, for example, you know, you circulating through Northwest D.C. looking at people with double or triple the national income per capita, and they turn out to be good parents. Well, I'm delighted. You know,
I'm comparing them to the other high income parents.
Well, okay. I mean, look, we're all here to learn and discover new things. However, again, I did get a whiff of sort of, you know, okay, men are bad, women are good in that whole bunch of Atlantic articles.
Well, this has actually been, there has been an element of this has been part of conservative discourse for a while. I remember reading way back when Christina Hoff Sommers saying, "Stop worrying about women and start worrying about men."
Yeah, she was right, and she got pummeled for it, and here we are now. I wonder if the people, you know, who were clobbering Miss Sommers, you know, 20 years ago are now going to say, "Gee, you were right." It'd be interesting to see. There's such a thing as being prematurely accurate about things.
Right, right. Well, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting debate. I have been, a part of me has fretted about this ever since I saw the movie The Full Monty, which people remember as a lighthearted film, but, I thought it was unbelievably depressing. Did you ever see that movie?
No, I never did, actually. No.
It's a whole... it's about the uselessness of men. It's about, you know, these men who can't hold on to a job because of deindustrialization, and so they redeem themselves by putting on a strip show for the women who are now running society. And it's all very upbeat and silly and funny, but you're thinking, you know, so this is all men have left to do is take off their clothes?
Well, again, I just point out to you that, you know, I don't think this same phenomenon, I mean, the phenomenon described in The Atlantic is probably happening in, Montgomery County, Maryland, and Marin County, California, and I don't think it's happening in Mexico, and I don't think it's happening in Venezuela, and I don't think it's happening in, Iran or Afghanistan.
It's not well. I know from my research that women are gaining on men income wise around the world. Now, obviously, some of that is just straight up, they move towards straight up equality.
Right, but I think in terms of patriarchy,
you don't see
patriarchy.
The disconnect. The patriarchy thing seems to be more pronouncedly American, and that's because men are doing much worse here than they are elsewhere. Right.
Well, again,
relative to women,
men are only a war or two away from being fully in charge again.
Women could be running wars too.
Maybe.
Which brings us to our next topic. Our next topic, which is Hillary Clinton,
Former
defense secretary. This is the new. And now I'm going to contradict myself by saying that I think Hillary Clinton is actually not a good choice for defense secretary. But there's this meme that's been floating around for a few months. And Les Gelb is the latest to endorse it in Saturday's Wall Street Journal. The question is, well, Gates is going to want to retire sooner or later. He's been in that job an awfully long time. Who can replace him? How about Hillary Clinton? And I don't understand what this is all about. I think at best we have absolutely no information on whether Hillary Clinton would be competent to run the Defense Department, but it does seem to me that in thinking about somebody for that job, we should be thinking about somebody who's, well, a defense expert. What is your thought?
Well, I mean, Hillary has a huge fan base sort of inside the sort of upper strata of the Democratic Party. They were for her husband, and a lot of them worked for her husband and in the administration, and then they were for her and for the Senate, and then they were for her for president against Obama. And I'm sure that they're going to be. You also read stories about her being Obama's vice president, and that she's going to challenge Obama for the 2012 Democratic nomination. She just has fans, people within the.
But we don't even have a lot of evidence that she's doing an especially good job running the State Department.
No, we don't. But as with diehard fans, the fact whether or not you do a good job or not doesn't really matter to the diehard fan, right? They love you anyway. And I think that there's a group that will just be pushing her for anything. That they can think of, Secretary General of the UN, Commissioner of the NFL. I mean, anything they can think of that they would like her to be on. But I think a lot of it revolves around a suspicion that Barack Obama is too liberal or too something or too left for their tastes. I think.
Right. I think that's right. It is is the main motivation behind it, is people like her tough rhetoric. Although her tough rhetoric doesn't seem to achieve a whole lot. It's hard to point to many concrete accomplishments.
I didn't write the biggest emergency
it seems to be we've had that got solved by the United States government wasn't solved by Hillary Clinton. It was solved by John Kerry when we were having big problems with Hamid Karzai, which I thought was actually kind of a slap in the face to our Secretary of State. Why did John Kerry have to step in and patch that up?
A good point. I mean, and by the way, for the record, I have a great respect for Bob Gates. I think he's a very able guy, and I think he's gone, way above beyond the call of duty in terms of, leadership through two administrations in an incredibly difficult job. And so, as far as I'm concerned, he should stay for 8 years, which I'm sure would annoy a lot of Hillaryites.
I don't think he's going to want to.
Probably not.
I think that is the underlying. Truth is he's been there. How many years has he been there already?
I guess he came in. I mean, in like November, December. Maybe he was confirmed by like January 2007. So whatever that makes it now, 3.5.
Cleaning
years.
Up after Rumsfeld's right. mess was, right. was a right. was a big job and probably an exhausting job.
Right.
And managing two wars. It's hard to see how anyone would want to do that for a full term. But maybe who knows. Mm-hmm. Why don't we move on to healthcare? You have a big healthcare story in National Review.
I did. Thank you for mentioning it. I in the June 21st issue, I made the argument, as I've been making for a while now, at my blog called SeriousMedicineStrategy.org, that what the American people want is more medicine, more cures, and that the existing political class, both Democratic and Republican, has kind of missed the point here about, you know, what the American people want. The game of fighting over Obamacare, pro and con, is incredibly important to the chattering class, incredibly important to talking heads, and incredibly important to political partisans. But if you're up against cancer or Alzheimer's or stroke or, you know, any number of other diseases, you don't really need ideology and rhetoric. You need a cure. And
Now, one question I had as I was reading the piece was that you didn't really sort of talk in any concrete terms about the NIH budget, which actually had a 10-year period when it had a huge surge. It basically almost doubled in real terms between this sort of start like mid-90s to the mid-aughts. Clinton really ramped it up in his second term, and in Bush's first term he continued to ramp it up for a few years, and then he leveled off spending. And Obama, I think they got a big chunk of money in the stimulus, but otherwise the spending there has leveled off. So it's not as if we haven't been spending a lot of money on research. Are you arguing that this is not a good time to allow funding for NIH to level off?
Well, I would say this. First of all, the NIH, you know, can withstand a lot of scrutiny as to whether or not they're really focused on research or more focused on self-perpetuation. That is a tendency of bureaucracies, as you know from your Washington Monthly days, you know, in terms of, you know, it is always a challenge to keep an organization focused on actually accomplishing something as opposed to simply getting its funding for next year. When you go to the NIH campus and you see that every building there has the name is, you know, named after a member of Congress, you get the feeling this has become more of a political playpen than an active research agency. Having said
Although
that,
the great bulk of their money goes out to various health organizations around the country.
Having said that, if the NIH budget is $30 billion a year, which is a good give or take, and they did get a bulge in the stimulus, but I think that is temporary, we could compare that to, say, the defense budget of $500 billion or, you know, any other number of other programs and say, is this really, if the challenge we face on healthcare is long-term care for the elderly in terms of Medicare, are we wise to commit trillions and trillions of dollars to dealing with people with Alzheimer's for 10 or 20 or 30 years at the end of their life? Or are we better off trying to cure Alzheimer's?
Now, do you actually see this as an either or? Do you imagine, because if you're just talking about spending more money on research, I think that's hard to argue with. And then the question just becomes, you know, sort of how much can we actually afford? But if you're saying, too bad, Grandma, you got Alzheimer's, but we're going to take the money we were going to spend taking care of you, and we're going to spend it on research instead, and just tough luck for you. I don't imagine you're saying that either.
No, I'm not saying that. We're going to make a commitment, and we're going to keep it to elderly people now, you know, who wind up with Alzheimer's or anything else. That's just the reality of...
We will grandfather them, so to speak.
Well, yeah.
What's been
lost, though, and again, it's not just a question of the NIH budget. It's also a question of how you deal with intellectual property. It's also a question of how you deal with the trial lawyers. It's also a question of how you deal with, you know, any number of antitrust issues and so on. It's also a question of just leadership. In other words, I would wager that every advanced country in the world has a concern about Alzheimer's for no other reason than the leaders themselves know that they're likely to wind up, you know, getting it. And so if President Obama wanted something to do, he could have convened all the leaders of the world and their sovereign wealth funds and the big pension funds and, you know, the big, you know, foundations, not only in the United States but around the world, and say, look, let's have a grand international consortium to deal with this. It would have been a confidence-building project. It would have been a good thing for Hillary Clinton to spend her time working on, you know, more fruitful than, you know, the next round of, you know, whatever we're doing in the Middle East. And it would have changed the game on terms of the imperative of searching for cures to the level that it reached in the United States in the 30s and 40s with the cure, the search for the cure for polio, and the creation of the polio vaccine, or the fight against AIDS in the 80s and 90s. I mean,
those are the positive associations. The negative association would be the war on cancer, where we spent a huge amount of money trying to solve that riddle.
And the death rate from cancer has fallen in half. You know, sometimes wars take a long time. We had a 30-years war. We've had a 100-years war. It was actually 116 years. I looked it up one time. I mean, sometimes war. I mean, what I think has happened to the cure strategy is that it's been caught in the downdraft of sort of general skepticism and pessimism about the competence of big institutions, and so they just sort of, you know, they've sort of forgotten that it's actually possible to go to the moon. It's actually possible to build the A-bomb. It's actually possible to cure diseases.
What is your evidence that the medical establishment is not?
I think it's the political establishment. The political establishment is not interested. The medical establishment is fine. It's the political establishment that is more interested in universal coverage and more interested in financing sickness and long-term care. And again, if I were really, I think I say it in the National Review piece, you know, look, maybe from a purely political point of view, in terms of a member of Congress seeking to maximize his or her tenure in office, it's best to have a lot of sick people on Medicare so that they remember that you voted to increase their Medicare payments every year. That's a plausible, you know, sort of a giant medical plantation, if you will. And whereas if you simply cure people, you know, it's like giving them a house in the suburbs as opposed to taking them out of public housing. You know, they're in public housing, they're Democrats. If they're in the suburbs, they tend to be Republicans. So maybe that's what's going on. But all we know for sure is that Franklin Roosevelt wanted to cure polio, and he did, admittedly, after he died. And, you know, Reagan and Bush and the leaders of Congress, Democrats and Republicans both, wanted to cure or at least substantially knock back AIDS, and they did. And now that discussion has fallen to, you know, number 800 on the list of priorities for the country. And we're seeing the results, which include basically no progress whatsoever on Alzheimer's, the biggest single public health problem we have.
Right. Well, you know, I'm certainly not going to quarrel with, I'm not going to quarrel with the importance of medical research. I do think you're shadow boxing a little bit. I don't think this is a notion that we'll find has very many opponents.
Well, unless
you're talking about an actual redistribution of resources away from current treatment of patients to research, then you might have a political.
No, I'm not for that either. What I am saying is that the annual GDP of this country is about $14 trillion, even post-crash and post-meltdown. Mm-hmm. And the total wealth of this country is about $55 trillion. And what I'm saying is that if somebody could figure out a way to coalesce through some combination of government activism, including savings bonds and debt and borrowing and voluntary contributions and naming rights and anything else, if somebody could put together a coalition to pull together, you know, $100 billion or $1 trillion or whatever it took to cure some of these big diseases, it would be wildly popular. That person would wind up as President of the United States or get reelected as President of the United States or win the Nobel Peace Prize or win the Nobel Prize for Medicine or, you know, God knows what other kind of prizes and honors that a grateful nation would bestow on them. It's just that we've developed a kind of feebleness about technological solutions. And the best example we can see right in front of us is this BP oil spill. I don't want to change the subject off of healthcare, but the fact that we sit there for 2 months now, we've been sitting wringing our hands about oil spills, and we've been sending out, you know, this high, allegedly high-tech country has been sending out people with mops and brooms and hefty bags to clean up oil spills. You know, where was the kind of technological thinking that said, look, if we're gonna drill these deep wells, we need robots and Iron Man and Transformer and whatever else equivalent to the challenge. And just It's unfortunate that nobody in the public discourse thinks like that in terms of why don't we have those kind of solutions? Why do we continue to fight the oil spill problem with infantry as opposed to tanks and airplanes? Why do we continue to deal with healthcare as a remedial issue? After you get sick, we will finance you. And that's a much higher priority than keeping you from getting sick.
Well, why don't we change the subject and talk about the oil spill?
All
because I think actually quite a lot of people are thinking about that now. I think your point is that they weren't thinking about it before the oil spill. But the president is giving a speech on, is it Tuesday or Wednesday?
Tuesday night, yeah.
And the question is, what should he say? And I have to say, I find this a very difficult problem. It is possible that you can, there are things the president can do, can talk about with respect to remediation of the spill. And we have seen criticism here and there of the effectiveness of remediation efforts so far. But the of course, the main concern right now is in plugging that hole. And it does appear as if there is really almost nothing the government can do on that score. We lack the know-how. We lack the technology. We do seem to be pretty reliant on BP's own quite imperfect technology, which is, you know, it's a frightening situation. But for a chief executive, you know, if I were Obama's political advisor, I'm not sure what I'd say, except I guess you got to find a really good way to bluff your way out of this, because we don't actually have a solution.
Right. I think that, you know, look, I'm sure that in the internal councils of the White House, you know, the David Axelrod left populist position has completely triumphed over the sort of pro-corporateness of Larry Summers and so on. And so I'm sure now corporate bashing is going to be big. And frankly, I think BP deserves it. I wondered for a long time why BP still has a corporate charter. You know, I mean, why there's any limited liability at all for them. I'd yank their charter and say, look, you know, we're going to go after your own personal assets, Tony Hayward and Mr. Svanberg and all the rest of you, to pay for all this.
Although my feeling is we'd probably do that after they fix the problem rather
well,
than before.
Okay.
We don't want to completely kill their motivation.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not sure the BP should be a company anymore, frankly. I mean, I think they just, I would just
I don't have an opinion about whether they should be a company. I do have my doubts about whether they will be a company.
Okay, fair enough. But so the point is, again, that's purely in the category of remediation. Look, if Obama had really wanted to solve this problem, he would have called in every expert in corporate technology and industrial technology and talk to them. He hadn't done,
don't we think that he or at least somebody in the White House has done that?
I'm sure he or somebody in the White House has done that, but I know...
I don't think there's somebody out there who knows the solution to this, who is waiting for his phone to ring.
Right, but what's clear is that, look, what the problem the Obama administration has is that half of them want to bash BP and clean up the oil spill and collect a lot of money and put every... You know, a shrimp farmer, you know, shrimp fisherman on the dole to make him happy and keep him quiet and stuff for the 2012 re-election campaign. And the other half see this as an opportunity to go back to cap and trade and fight against global warming and, quote, energy reform, as they call it, which is code for, you know, the same environmental agenda that was rejected in 2009. And so in that split, they are missing the chance to say that what the American people want, even if they can't quite articulate it, is a system by which we drill for oil, and then if there's the slightest little leak, it gets cleaned up. And that's where, again, you know, Steve Jobs and people like that are waiting. You know, they've got better things to do, but I'm sure if somebody called them up and said, look, how would you handle this problem, they'd have a completely different answer than you're getting from the usual gang of Beltway military-industrial complex contractors that are now providing the echo chamber. In other words, Obama should say, and if you know, hopefully he'll see this before tomorrow morning, before tomorrow night. I'm kidding, but I think he should. He should say we're going to have a crash program to build machines that will prevent this from ever happening again. Some people say
why shouldn't he say let's pass cap and trade? I mean, cap and trade. I'm a little baffled as to how cap and trade became a controversial idea with conservatives in the first place.
Because it's an idiotic boondoggle for Wall Street. That's why.
It was. But this whole notion originated as a kind of conservative alternative.
No, it didn't. It originated as Bob Rubinism. It originated as the unholy marriage of Bob Rubin and the Cato Institute. with the Cato Institute not really being for it. So it just, it was sort of a parody of using the market to enrich Wall Street traders. If you loved Enron, and you think they were doing good things for the country, then you'll love cap and trade. If you think carbon is a bad thing, then you can just flat out say, let's tax carbon. The American people will vote against you, of course, but at least you have an intellectually honest position.
That's part of the package too, isn't it? As I understand it, the carbon tax.
I never heard carbon tax.
I have not had a chance to check it, but I actually just asked somebody today, whatever happened to the carbon tax? And somebody said, oh, it's actually in there.
Well, maybe it is, but it was well hidden precisely because they knew that the last time they tried a carbon tax, which was, Al Gore when he was vice president in 1993, it got beat. So they hid it. I mean,
it was the BTU tax. I have to pause and say that was the occasion for my finest lead ever as a writer for the Wall Street Journal, when the Clinton administration came in and they were proposing a BTU tax, and Gore went up to Congress to try and sell it, the place was a swarm of lobbyists who were cutting themselves exemption after exemption after exemption before the whole thing finally collapsed under its own weight. But right before it collapsed under its own weight, I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal whose lead was, if you haven't gotten yourself exempted yet from the BTU tax, maybe you just aren't trying.
Right. I think that, again, there's plenty of people who think we should have cap and trade. We should have a carbon tax. The problem is they're just not a majority or anything close in the country. So if you want something that will actually work, what you offer people is a way to drill so they can still have gas at $2.50 a gallon and not destroy the environment. And I think that the environmentalists will not be interested in real machinery to clean up oil spills because they basically don't believe in offshore oil anyway. And meanwhile, the libertarians will say, well, we don't believe in government projects to build machines and technology, so we'll kind of be stuck with what we'll do is we'll not have offshore oil drilling for a while and just import more from Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. How's that for a plan?
Well, moving on to another natural resources topic. Possibly the most intriguing story of the day is a New York Times report, and I think others had it as well, that we have just learned that Afghanistan, a country that until yesterday we thought was utterly devoid of any resources whatsoever, turns out to be sitting on about $1 trillion worth of mineral wealth. I guess the question is, is that good news or bad news?
Well, it's good news for the Chinese. this whole issue of minerals, there was a story a couple of years ago, literally 2 years ago, about some copper mine in Anaya, A-N-A-Y-A, Afghanistan, whatever that is, that the Americans were guarding and the Chinese were mining. So the Americans were the policemen for the Chinese while they dug this copper out of Afghanistan. And nobody was throwing around the $1 trillion number back then, but it was just simply an interesting example of the American approach to foreign policy, which is we want to occupy your country so we can have bases, and other people's approach to foreign policy, which is we want to occupy your country so we can mine your resources.
Right.
I think the Chinese get the better end of that deal. And I think the Chinese
model. They do. On the other hand, do we consider the alternative? Do we want the Chinese to have a military so vast that it can easily spare a few divisions to guard a copper mine in Afghanistan? I'm not sure we do.
Well, how do we stop them?
We don't stop them,
okay.
But we don't necessarily encourage them either.
Well, I'm not encouraging them. I suppose in a perfect world the Afghans would mine their own copper. But it, since they don't seem to know how to do it, or the Chinese are outbidding them for it, again, America has spent trillions putting, a 1,000 military bases in 100 countries so that we can, surround China and surround Russia. And it's not really clear what we're getting for it. It's not like we're mining the copper in Afghanistan or taking the oil from the Iraqis. We're not doing anything except getting our troops killed. Meanwhile, other countries are moving in to take the resources. It is historians will scratch their heads at, you know, how the Americans got in their minds that the purpose of foreign military operations was to transform civilizations of places that didn't want their civilization transformed, and to fight wars against guerrillas, while other
countries... Well, this is part of the bigger story, which is, you know, why would anyone want to be the world's foremost power? It wasn't a lot of fun for the British. It's not necessarily a lot of fun for us either.
Right. It's incredibly expensive, and it gives you a sense of glory, but you get a lot of people killed.
It also spares you having somebody else do it who would have less commitment to high ideals.
Right. Our high ideals of Karzai and his brother and so on. Yeah. Exactly.
It's all relative.
Putting the Shia in charge of Iraq. I mean, yeah, we've been doing great on this.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the what are the really interesting parts of the story is obviously that this was discovered a while ago by Soviets, back when the Soviets were there. They had some geologists sort of snooping around and they discovered, you know, wow, there's actually a lot of minerals here. They made these maps when the Soviets left, a bunch of geologists in Afghanistan, they secreted away and hid from the Taliban, which was probably a good idea. But then after the Americans came back, the Americans found out about it, and they were not in a hurry to tell anybody about it. And I can imagine there were some interesting conversations along the lines of what, you know, if we let the world know that Afghanistan is sitting on fantastic resources of titanium and gold and so forth, you know, will that make our war effort that much more difficult? Will, you know, not only do you have the Taliban who we're fighting here, but we also have a country filled with warlords who would suddenly have, you know, something new to fight each other over. You know, strategically, it's economically, it's ultimately good news for Afghanistan, but strategically, it's kind of a mess.
To me, everything you need to know about Afghanistan and the American effort there is, you know, a couple times now, General McChrystal, who seems like a fine man, has gone on national Afghan TV, and I use that term loosely, to apologize for, you know, blowing up a wedding party here or a bus there and so on. And guess what language he's speaking in 9 years after, or almost 9 years after we went to Afghanistan? He's speaking English. Okay. If the Afghans...
The problem is you got several languages to choose from Afghanistan. If you pick one, you're going to piss off the others.
Then you should do it twice in two different languages. If the Afghans came to Maryland and said, we're here to help you and we're your friends, but by the way, we're not going to bother to learn your language after 9 years, I don't think even the peaceable, feminist, you know, women-dominated people of Montgomery County, Maryland would like it very much, to say nothing of Darlington County, South Carolina, which I'm sure is run by patriarchs.
That is a fair point.
And I know Afghanistan is patriarchal. It's just sort of laughable that we think we can do anything. I mean, I know plenty of people who've been back and forth to Iraq in various capacities and so on, and I've always asked them, did you learn any Arabic? Did you learn any Dari or Pashto? And the answer is no.
Right.
They use translators, and these translators I don't think are to be trusted on the whole. And it's just sort of comic that you think you're going to get anywhere in the internal politics of these countries if you are so oblivious to their culture that you don't even know the language.
Well, the irony is funny. I was talking with someone a couple of years ago who was an Arabic scholar, and she had come to Washington, and she was looking for a job with the government, and she thought, you know, I should have no problem getting a job, right? Except that you show up at some government agency, and you say, here, I am here to sell my skills as a speaker of Arabic. And then suddenly all their antenna go up, and they say, hey, how come you know Arabic anyway? What the hell's going on with you? What are your politics? It's this sort of ridiculous situation where they desperately need speakers of Arabic, and at the same time, if you can speak Arabic, they immediately think that you are probably a disloyal American.
Right, and that's a poor plan for imperialism. I got to tell you, it does seem to me, though, that this issue of titanium and cobalt and gold and so on in Afghanistan, which, again, it's great news for the Afghans, if they could ever figure out a way to mine it peacefully, is sort of a reminder, it's sort of the kind of the Julian Simon point, the late libertarian economist, that, look, this stuff is everywhere. You know, as we discovered in the Gulf of Mexico, there seems to be a lot of oil under the ground. There's a lot more than dead dinosaurs can account for. It looks to me like the Earth is creating oil as we go along here. And
I keep waiting for somebody to write the piece saying that the oil spill is good news because it turns out there's a hell of a lot more oil in the Gulf than we realize.
Yeah, I mean, it seems the oil spill is not good news, but it does seem like we got a lot of oil. And I suspect when the smoke clears, we're going to have a lot of cobalt and gold and titanium and everything else, too. And if it's under Afghanistan, that probably means it's under Nebraska, too, if we just look hard enough.
If it's under Afghanistan, too, there's very little landscape you have to worry about spoiling. I'm probably going to get in trouble for saying that.
Well, they like it.
They're going to like the money a lot more.
Right. But I think that we're going to wake up 20 years from now and realize the Chinese, with a cynical realpolitik approach of, look, we don't care what you do to your people. We don't care what your religion is. Just give us take this money and let us set up a hermetic compound in the middle of your country so we can mine your molybdenum and manganese and so on, and we'll take it out so we can build electronic parts or missiles for back home in China. That's a much more sustainable model than we're here to empower your women and emancipate your minorities, which tends to develop a backlash in third world countries.
Right. We sure as hell don't want anyone in the Muslim countries reading Hannah Rosen's cover story.
I got to tell you, I think they'd read it and say, look, this is not really relevant to our situation, and we'll just go back to castrating women and stuff.
Well, no, I was thinking the opposite, that it would sort of validate a terrorist's worldview.
Oh, I see, right, right.
This is what happens when you let them out of the burqas. They take over the whole country.
Well, again, I mean, we've got a culture here that we're proud of for the most part, and that, other countries, we got a whiff of that on 9/11. We've sort of forgotten that, our culture attracts a lot of people and repulses a lot of people.
Well, and actually, the serious underlining point here is, we're talking about that bell curve for sort of male behavior. It's terrorism, obviously. Terrorists are almost always men, and it does. Represent, among other things, a culture where men and women, to some extent, also, but in a patriarchal society, it's of greater concern to the men that they find themselves with little means to find a place for themselves in the world.
Well, that's why we have football, and that's why. And seriously, men create institutions that they can do well in, and if they're the football players and the soccer players and the warriors, I suspect they don't really care very much who's shuffling papers in an office somewhere.
Well, I think there's a famous Margaret Mead quote, isn't there, where she says the central problem for every civilization is to figure out what to do with young men.
Right. Right.
It's true. It's a sobering thought. And this has been true since long before this trend that Anna wrote about. That men create the lion's share of the trouble in the world.
Right, and if you're the parent of teenage boys, I'm not speaking about you personally, but I mean, a parent of teenage boys knows the value of having a father around. A parent of teenage boys knows the value of having a male in the household.
Right.
To kick the kid's ass. Because much of the time, and I speak as you and I are both former teenage males, need a little, constructive asking.
Right. I take it you're the father of a teenager?
No, I'm not, but I'm a former teenage boy.
Oh, okay.
Raised by a single mother for quite a while, and then I had a stepfather came in who was great. And was incredibly valuable and important to me. And, if you have two lesbian parents and one's, really tough, then I guess can perform the same function. But feminine maternal values on a teenage male is a tough mix in terms of raising them.
It's obviously a big and complicated subject. But I will put in a good word for my teenage male son, who's actually quite well behaved.
Okay, that's because he's got you around.
I like to think so. I very much doubt it, but I like to think so. My teenage daughter is also pretty swell too,
okay.
I must say here. But then you get into the whole question of nature versus nurture, which is I think beyond the scope of our
discussion. We've done enough politically incorrect bell curving for this.
Well, have I missed any of the topics that we pledged to discuss
we did,
today?
Fred Malik. I think you have an opinion.
Fred Malik.
You have an opinion on Fred Malik. We shouldn't let that go.
Yes, I was going to. Discuss Fred Malik. Fred Malik. I have been writing a lot about Fred Malik, who was appointed to a government reorganization panel in Virginia by the governor, Republican Governor Bob McDonnell, and this provided an occasion for me to. Write about Malik's misbehavior in the Nixon administration in 1971. Richard Nixon, in an unusually deranged moment, which is saying something, ordered H.R. Haldeman, his chief of staff, to have somebody count the number of Jews at the Bureau of Labor Statistics because he was convinced that there was a cabal there that had it in for him. And he thought that because at a press conference, there was a press conference, maybe more than one, I can't recall, where a BLS employee gave an actual honest assessment of the unemployment data, the honest assessment was slightly, by implication, not in itself, dismissive of some ridiculous positive spin that Nixon was trying to put on the unemployment figures. So as a result of this, he decided that the Jews at the BLS had it in for him, he ordered Malik to render the BLS Judenfrei, as they said in back in the days of the Reich, and it fell to Fred Malik, a young aide, although not too young, it's important to say, he was in his early to mid-30s, to compile a list for Nixon of 13 Jews in the BLS, later expanded to 19, we have learned from some new documents. And this story surfaced initially in the final days, a book by Woodward and Bernstein in 1976. And then the hard proof surfaced in 88 during the first presidential campaign of Bush 1. Woodward and Walter Pincus wrote a piece for the Post saying, we have the goods on Malik. He did write this memo. And we also have some circumstantial evidence that after the memo was written, he was directly involved in the demotion of two people. Malik pled guilty to compiling the list, but he, in outraged terms, denied that he would have had anything even marginally to do with demoting anybody at the BLS. Thereby, Malick acquired a reputation for having come clean. Years later, the evidence surfaced in the Nixon archives that, incontrovertible evidence in the form of memos, that Malick was intimately involved in the demotion of not two, but at least four members of the BLS with Jewish surnames who had been on Malick's list. And Malick has never fessed up to this, and I find it infuriating. It's a complicated story, and so a lot of reporters haven't followed it closely. So a lot of reporters easily get hoodwinked by Malick and others into the simplified version of the story, which was Malick got caught having done something bad in his youth. He apologized. He gave a lot of money to Jewish organizations. He said he was really ashamed of himself, and then he moved on. Well, he never acknowledged his role in the worst part of it, which was the demotions. And as I ended one of my dispatches on this, if that's atonement, then I'm St. Francis of Assisi. Do you have any Malick thoughts?
I mean, I was in the 1988 Bush campaign, and remember when he was appointed deputy chairman of the Republican National Committee, which is sort of the traditional job that goes to the perk of the new presidential candidate, is he appoints the deputy or either picks the new chairman of the RNC or picks a deputy to go underneath him, and then Malick lasted 2 weeks or whatever it was, back in 1988.
The context, as I recall, is that he had to go instantly because Bush had been making a big deal out of Jesse Jackson's famous Hymietown remark that was derisive about Jews. And
Hymietown was 84. I think it was just seen as this is not cricket or kosher, to have this person around.
He's a liability to the campaign. I didn't remember that.
Hymietown was 84. You're just not supposed to do bad things, and you're supposed to be punished if you do. It was interesting to me. Anybody who was in Washington, back in 1988, remembers that incident well with Malick.
It was shocking. It was a shocking story.
It was a big deal.
I remember reading and thinking, this was 1971, not 1917.
Right.
That level of Nixon's level of anti-Semitism was astonishing for 1971. People did talk that way, in the 40s, but by 1971, we were living in a different country.
And what was interesting though was that Governor McDonnell, I live in Virginia and I voted for him last year, said, "Gee, I had no idea."
Right.
I believe him. But you've got to wonder, come on guys, get a good staff together
or at least go on Google.
Your good staff being defined as somebody who has heard of Google. To go through carefully the people you're picking for jobs. We have simultaneously a culture of sort of Twitter and forgetting and evanescence and quick thoughts that come and go, and then meanwhile we're piling up these databases of which Nexus for us oldsters and. Factiva and then obviously Google and Bing and whatever that in effect know everything. Any last little secret about anybody that ever got published is most likely in one database or another. And so even if you don't know anything, and even if your life is your iPod in terms of what you're listening to and knowing about, but you can pull yourself away from that for long enough to type in some names and searches and so on like that. And if the McDonnell administration had done that, I suspect they wouldn't have appointed it. But I confess, is Malick still in this job?
He is still in this job. It's a remarkable lesson in Washington's notion of respectability. What has saved Malick is that Jewish organizations don't want to go after him. I think mainly because he basically shut them up by stuffing money down their throats. And so, you know, the way people in the kind of political media world think is, you know, Jewish organizations not complaining, well, then there can't really be a problem with compiling a list of 13 Jews in the BLS and then demoting four of them and copying to the first part but not to the second part. It's I guess that's sort of the mechanistic way that the media world thinks.
Right. If it's not enough of a fight, then we don't need it. We don't need to cover it because we only really need to worry about fights.
Yeah, you know, it's but
are anything still alive? Any of the 13 still alive?
I don't know. That's a good question. There was somebody contacted a couple of them a few years ago, and they were very anxious not to make a big deal out of it. They to the extent that they were angry not at Malik, but at Nixon. And of course, they didn't know about this was before it was demonstrated that Malik had been involved in their demotions, and they had never known about what the particular mechanisms had been for their demotions. But to the extent that they were angry, they were angry at Nixon. And of course, you know, Nixon should be the main person they were angry at. But they didn't, you know, they were both quite elderly, and they didn't especially feel like picking a fight with Fred Malik.
Mm. Mm. Well, I mean, it was a good catch and on your part, again, media lessons of, okay, forgetfulness by the larger culture, the power of Google and Nexus for people who care enough about it, and then the reality that if it doesn't bleed enough or burn enough to lead, the story can nonetheless kind of get shuffled aside.
Maybe we could, if you wanted to put it in purely technological terms, you could call it Google v. Twitter.
Yeah.
Google stands for remembering things until the end of time. Twitter stands for not really paying attention to anything for more than about 5 seconds.
And then some, you know, whatever the, you know, synecdoche for like a homepage is or something, you know, whatever, you know, the Drudge Report or just whatever it is that would make it linger in your mind. Does it go viral?
Right.
You know, did you make a YouTube video of this?
I haven't, but I will confess to being somewhat obsessive on this topic.
Well,
intermittently for about 10 years now.
All right. Well, then
my first go around at this was when Malik was positioned to own the Washington D.C. baseball team, and I wrote several pieces saying, as a D.C. taxpayer, I object to underwriting the guy who counted Jews for Nixon. At that point, I didn't even know about the proof of his role in the demotions, although even then there was substantial reason to suspect that he had been involved in those, too.
Well, you might think about a YouTube video. Mix up Hitler's Nuremberg speech and whatever else there's a lot of you've got some intern who can help you on this, or your kids can help you,
or maybe hire a guy to do skywriting. That's another way to go. But anyway, well, thank you for indulging me in my hobby horse here. We have spoken for an hour, and I've enjoyed this conversation.
It's been fun, yes, thank you. We will wrap up and turn this over to the Blogging Heads production crew. Tim?
That's great.
Nice talking to you.
Good talking to you, Jim.
Very good. Thanks.